Australia in the World is a podcast produced with the support of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. The AAA wants Australians to know, understand and engage more in international affairs. All views expressed are solely those of the speakers themselves.
Hello and welcome back to the Australia in the World podcast. As always, you're with Darren Lim from the Australian National University, and it's Friday the 22nd today. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi visited Australia this week, the first visit for a Chinese foreign minister since 2017. He had meetings with his counterpart, of course, Penny Wong, but also met with Prime Minister Albanese, opposition leader Dutton, Shadow Foreign Minister Birmingham, and, controversially, former Prime Minister Paul Keating. Now, foreign ministers visit all the time. Today, in fact, Foreign Minister Wong and Defence Minister Miles are meeting with their UK counterparts in Adelaide for the AUKMIN consultations. But of course, China is different. And while the bilateral relationship may be stabilised, there is still going to be more scrutiny, more analysis, more hand-wringing of every aspect of a visit like this, because the stakes are high. And so I therefore do think it's worth a dedicated episode. And I'm joined again by the ABC Stephen Jedgetts, who has been following and reporting on the visit all week. Stephen, hello. You are becoming a regular and I'm very grateful for it. So thanks once again for taking the time.
Darren, I'm even more grateful to be given the opportunity. So thanks.
Well, I want to start by just challenging the premise of my intro then. Is this visit worth a dedicated episode? Of course, with infinite time, Stephen, you and I would happily pay close attention to every high-level meeting that happens. We'd be pigs in mud. But with apologies to my UK friends and colleagues, I don't expect to be dedicating an episode to the AUKMIN consultations happening today. Now, with China, stabilisation is bringing a familiar rhythm to bilateral diplomacy. Penny Wong visited in late 2022, the PM visited late last year. Yes, this is the first meeting for a Chinese foreign minister since 2017, but that was also true for New Zealand, where Wang Yi visited before coming here, and the Kiwis haven't had quite the same bumpy road that we've had in recent years. So should we consider this just a normal visit now? And I note that the ABC, amongst others, was including updates on its daily politics blog, so it's being treated as sufficiently newsworthy, but are we all just making too much of a fuss?
Look, to some degree, perhaps, yeah. You're right, of course. This is just now the resumption of normal diplomacy, high-level diplomacy in particular, between Australia and China. And it would have been far more newsworthy, in a sense, if this meeting didn't happen. After all, it was our turn to host. The foreign and strategic dialogue is up and running again. And so in that sense, it's unremarkable that it took place. But I'm still very comfortable with doing an episode on this, and I'm comfortable with the ABC and others running a live blog or including updates on the meeting in our live blog, simply because the relationship remains so consequential on so many levels for Australia, undoubtedly more consequential than our relationship with the UK, as important as that relationship is. So are we making too much of a fuss of it? Look, I don't think so. If there was one small gripe I have is that people around the traps probably got a little bit too fixated on this line about it being the first meeting in 7 years, as you point out. That in itself is only a consequence of the relationship tumbling down a mineshaft and then, of course, COVID on top of that. So in that sense, what we're seeing is unremarkable. But it was still a consequential meeting, and I think it still deserves and merits close scrutiny.
Okay, well, let's remind ourselves of the context for this visit. The last few months of 2023 saw a flurry of policy activity, with both sides making policy choices that were favourable to the interests of the other, though there might be some disagreement on whether they are linked. China, for example, released Chengli, set up the expiry of the wine duties at the end of this month, while Australia kept the Darwin port lease in place, assessed it appropriate for wind tower duties to expire, and agreed to suspend the WTO case on wine in addition to suspending the barley one previously. So what was on the agenda as the leaders came together this week? What were the specific interests of the two sides, do you think?
Look, there was a long and probably largely unsurprising list of topics, many difficult and fraught, that the two sides had to manage. Look, I mean, in a sense, the list is so long that it's difficult to pick out which ones we should focus on or which are the most consequential. Obviously, this drew a lot of headlines. There was a focus on the Australian side, on those remaining consular cases in China. And at the top of that list, although it's not the only one, is, of course, Dr. Yang Hunjun. Penny Wong told Wang Yi that the suspended death sentence that he was handed was one that Australians found shocking. that language, I guess, is unsurprising in the sense that the government has already been pretty strident in its criticism. I think the government does accept, at least to a degree, that this decision and this verdict is not primarily about the bilateral relationship. It's much more complex than that. Any analysis that says that Dr. Yang Hongjun is nothing more than a victim of the deterioration of the relationship between Australia and China is certainly missing a fair chunk of the point. But I don't think Australia was necessarily expecting any substantial breakthroughs on that front. And Penny Wong, unsurprisingly, was pretty coy when pressed for details about exactly what Australia wants. It's impossible to say whether there were any major breakthroughs on this, simply because no one in the room, understandably, is talking about exactly what Penny Wong proposed or exactly what pressure was applied, what sort of bargain they may be pushing for, whether they're still trying to get some sort of clemency deal that would allow Dr. Yang Hongjun to eventually come back to Australia, or whether they're simply pressing for the death penalty to be pushed aside, as China has hinted that it may be. It's difficult to draw any conclusions, but obviously the foreign minister wanted to flag publicly after the meeting that this was near the top of the government's agenda. Other topics, well, there's the long and very predictable list, including regional flashpoints, China's ambitions in the Pacific, its attempts to get a security foothold in the Pacific, the Taiwan Strait, nickel prices, trade impediments, and a long, long, long list of other...
How long do they meet for? Do you know?
It's an interesting question. Originally, it was flagged that it would be around a three-hour meeting. In the end, I'm told it didn't run as long as that. It was about an hour and a half or perhaps 2 hours. So it didn't run over time. It may even have run under time slightly. But look, given the breadth of issues up for discussion, it probably ran for about the period you'd expect. What I'm trying to get at the moment, Darren, is a real sense as to whether there was just a recitation of talking points or whether it was pretty free-flowing. One person tells me it was a very free-flowing and genuine conversation. Whether they made any breakthroughs on any of these fronts, we won't know. And perhaps the Australian side won't know for at least a few weeks or months until some of those decisions start to filter out of the Chinese side. A couple of other ones to point to briefly. Obviously, Australia is still pressing China on wine. We expect that within the next 5 or so days, perhaps 10 at the most, we'll see those wine tariffs dropped in the wake of the interim decision that China handed down earlier this month. Australia seems supremely confident on that front. There was an attempt by the Chinese side, not just state media, but Wang Yi himself, to link that wine decision to Australia's decision, which we've discussed before, to let tariffs on Chinese wind turbines lapse. But unsurprisingly, Penny Wong was absolutely adamant there was no quid pro quo in the offing, and that on the one hand, you essentially had the Chinese withdrawing an act of political retaliation, on the other side, and totally independent government agency simply making an absolutely clear-eyed judgment about whether the tariffs should remain in place on a business basis and deciding to let them drop. And then, of course, on top of that, you've got all of the broader questions around things like clean energy, trade, Chinese complaints about barriers to Chinese investment in sensitive sectors like critical minerals. The list really does roll on.
On wind turbines, the relevant minister, Husic, made a call last week, didn't he? So for an independent decision, the timing is really quite perfect to set up for the foreign minister's visit this week. But I suppose that just means that the schedulers were very effective in setting up the meeting.
Yeah, I mean, the timing here is interesting, to say the least. You can accept the government's argument that this was basically a technical decision that the Anti-Dumping Commission made, free from any arm twisting from the government, and still question exactly why Ed Husic, the minister, signed off on it literally a few days before Wang Yi arrived in the country. I suspect at the very least that the government wanted to see that particular deck cleared before the meeting took place. Now, that of course exposes you to the risk that the Chinese presented, as they have, as a straight quid pro quo, but perhaps that's just the price of doing business.
And to me, timing is one of the few things you have control over. You're not undermining or severely degrading our political and legal institutions. You're allowing them to do their thing. But in the world of messy foreign policy, Alan made this point regularly, that statecraft is messy, foreign policy is messy. Where there are red lines that we cannot cross if we want to keep our own house in order. But beyond those, you need to be creative. And so I would support creative use of timing as a way of achieving Australia's broad national interest. given my assessment that I don't think our institutions are endangered by tweaking that.
As you say, there are certain red lines that we have to operate within, as we should, as we have to. Timing is perhaps one of the few things that we can control. Exactly how deftly that timing is handled is another question. In the case of the wind turbines, it looks pretty clear, and I think it's pretty defensible if this decision was genuinely made with an eye on nothing more than the merits of the case.
Let's talk about nickel. If the wine and the wind turbine and the economic blockages, I guess we still have lobsters and some of the beef issues outstanding, but it seemed like a new tension was brewing. The Foreign Minister Wong made some public comments about nickel. Can you talk us through the dynamics of that? Is it a brewing dispute or dark clouds on the horizon? What's going on?
Look, I don't think it's going to emerge as a major point of tension, simply because I think Australia is pretty realistic about the amount of pressure it can put on China on this point. Look, basically, the Australian nickel industry is under enormous pressure at the moment because producers from China and Indonesia are really flooding the market with what the Australian market calls lower quality nickel. It is lower quality, but you know, there's a bit of a pejorative tinge to that phrase sometimes. And not only that, it's not just Indonesia and China producing it, but it's also China investing very heavily in Indonesia's nickel refineries. Now, that's all putting enormous pressure on the Australian nickel industry because they create a more expensive product. And even though it's cleaner and more environmentally friendly, it's struggling to find a niche at the moment. So the Resources Minister, Madeleine King and others are trying to go to other countries, including the US, Canada, I think the EU as well, saying, hey, how can we create a market for this cleaner nickel that actually attracts a premium and which ensures that we have a niche in a market being flooded by the stuff from Indonesia and China? Obviously, the international nickel price and China's role in that is something that Penny Wong has flagged publicly that she's raised. But I can't see Australia really having any significant leverage in this space. And the Chinese side, I can't see why they would have any particular interest in facilitating a particular niche for the Australian product. In the end, the drivers here, climate drivers as well as financial incentives at play, are very, very clear. And I can't see why China and Indonesia wouldn't continue to flood the market with as much cheap nickel as possible.
Okay. Well, I think we do need to turn to Paul Keating. But before we do, I mean, overall, what's your sense of the mood in Canberra? The visit was a success? We did what we needed to do? Or how do you read that mood?
Yeah, look, everyone that I've spoken to seems relatively happy with how it played out. No one was expecting any major breakthroughs. And if there were major breakthroughs that will be announced when we see the Premier in town, perhaps in June, then no one's spilling the beans to me about what they might have been. I get the sense that Australia ran through everything that it wanted to run through. The Chinese side made the points that you'd expect them to make. It was apparently a pretty free-flowing discussion. I don't think there were any huge shocks. And the atmospherics around it were, broadly speaking, pretty good. I think there was a level of angst in Canberra about the protests that we saw. I mean, everyone knew that there were going to be protests. They might have been slightly more energetic and got slightly closer to the foreign minister than some people, at least on the Chinese side, would have liked. And I'm aware of that generating a little bit of angst in the Australian system. But that's the price of doing business in Australia. We're a free country and protesters will and should be permitted to make their point, including directly to the Chinese foreign minister. I don't get the sense that there were any huge shocks out of the meeting, but I think there is, I guess, collectively a bit of a sigh of relief around Canberra that there were no major disruptions and no disasters and that everything ran, broadly speaking, pretty smoothly.
All right. Well, on to the former Prime Minister. So some context for our foreign listeners. Paul Keating was Prime Minister from 1991 to 1996. And in recent years has been sharply critical of the Australian government's policy towards China. He was scathing of the coalition when they were in government, but he's only been mildly less harsh towards his own Labor Party since they took office in 2022. I would summarise his critique as being that Australian strategic thought is too focused on the security risks that in his view are not sufficiently grave, and it's been dominated by security policymakers who, in his view, exacerbate this myopic focus on security. And finally, I think he would then add to that that there is too much of a prioritization of the alliance with an increasingly unreliable United States, which is then in turn undermining Australia's independence. That's a summary of what I understand his beliefs to be. Now, Keating met privately with Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Sydney after Wang had done the Canberra portion of his trip. So, Stephen, I've got a long take on this, but can you walk us through the lead up to this private meeting? What was the Australian government saying about it? What was the understanding in Canberra about why it was happening?
Look, I think it's safe to say that people in Canberra, both politicians and officials, were not delighted by the Keating meeting. I think some of the commentary around it was a little bit overheated, but there's no doubt that China was engaging in some pretty clear signalling here, not just putting Paul Keating on a pedestal beyond the rather substantial one that he's already got as a former prime minister, but also, of course, trying to drive that wedge into the, at least the broader Labour movement or the progressive side of politics, whose reservations Keating has summed up time and time again in increasingly strident language. So I do think that people around Canberra were frustrated by it. They felt, I'm told, that when it was requested, they had no option other than to agree to facilitate it. But I think Paul Keating's summary that it was an unremarkable meeting and the fact that PMNC facilitated it, that fact somehow amounted to some sort of imprimatur from the federal government, it goes a little bit too far. There's no doubt there that the people in Canberra were very clear-eyed about exactly what China was trying to signal here, the way he was trying to use Keating to not only privilege and to promote his worldview, but to stoke a little bit of trouble within the broader Labour movement. All of that was pretty transparent.
What's your assessment of, look, I've heard the fact that the meeting happened described as insulting and humiliating. I'm assuming that wasn't the vibe around the traps in Canberra. Did you get that sense, or was it more frustration and vexation that was this overriding emotion?
Look, I think that's a fair way to describe it. I think people were, at the very least, irritated, in some cases, vexed by the meeting. Some, though, were simply not surprised by it. We've seen this playbook before, China going to respected elder statesmen who happen to be fierce critics of Western government's policies in an attempt to privilege their worldview. It's not, in that sense, hugely surprising. The federal opposition was pretty forceful on it. They described it, in at least one instance, as a deliberate insult. I mean, that's a reasonable way to describe it, but I don't think people in Canberra were in a panic about it. Of course they would rather this meeting didn't happen. Of course they would rather that Keating wasn't such a forceful critic. And of course they would rather the Chinese weren't so intent on drawing attention to it. I don't think, though, that it caused deep angst in Canberra. Certainly I didn't pick up any sense of panic around it.
Well, I've got a model for you, Stephen. Do you want to hear it? I've been thinking about this.
Always, every time. We've missed your models, Darren.
Well, I'm trying to think it through the lens of statecraft. Why are you doing this? And you've offered a couple of explanations, looking to elevate his worldview and perhaps drive somewhat of a wedge into the Labour movement. I'm trying to connect that to a theory of influence. And one model is that it is a show of dominance and power. We can do this. We can elevate his view, and that we in some ways want, or at least don't mind if you're a bit humiliated. And I can't rule that out. But of course, it's not going to be an effective way of actually influencing Australia's behaviour. And having just tried to change Australian policy over the past few years through actual punishment, it seems very unlikely that there's been a calculation by Wang Yi or by Beijing that this is going to be an effect, you know, that the humiliation aspect is going to be an effective way of actually getting what they want. So what else could this calculation be? And this is where you alluded to this, Stephen. I'm calling it the Kissinger model, right? All the way through to his death last year, Henry Kissinger, a former Secretary of State, a National Security Advisor in the United States, engaged very closely with Beijing as a private citizen. Now, a lot of this was commercial work. He was making money, trading on his connections to Beijing. But to me, it never seemed to be only about money. Kissinger was on the record as being really concerned about war between the US and China. He advocated consistently to successive US governments for a less confrontational approach. And I think he was genuine when he did so. And I think regardless of the merits of his arguments, I think that for Beijing, they saw someone who understood their interests, who understood their assessment of the landscape and their perspective. He wasn't some paid for shill or a useful idiot. He was a respected member of the foreign policy community who was staking out a reasonable position that was nevertheless closer to Beijing's view than the mainstream, certainly in recent years. And this meant he was someone the Chinese thought they could talk to and have a productive conversation with. Now, I don't know, of course, whether he then performed a back channel function where he communicated with the White House what he was talking about, but it's possible. And at the very least, as you say, is a signal from Beijing about what they hope for from the relationship. And if we just review the last year of his life, last year in 2023, the Chinese ambassador visited him at his home to wish him a happy birthday in May when he turned 100, at a time when US-China tensions were very, very high in the aftermath of the balloon incident. Then in July of last year, he traveled to Beijing and met with Xi Jinping and Wang Yi and China's defense minister. And I want to quote Xi here, quote, "The Chinese people never forget their old friends, and Sino-US relations will always be linked with the name of Henry Kissinger." Now, this was at a time, as I said, where tensions were very high. Why is this happening? Well, I think because Kissinger embodied not only a nostalgia for where the relationship was, but more concretely, he represented what Beijing wants from the relationship now. And so they roll out the red carpet for him. That's partly a cultural inclination to respect what he has done and the close relationship he has in personally with China's leaders, and as a signaling mechanism for Washington. Now, again, I'm not saying this is an effective means of statecraft. Kissinger was, of course, reviled by a lot of the foreign policy establishment, but we don't know what happens behind the scenes. And to me, it's plausible, even likely. Certainly, if I was inside the White House, I would want to know what he was talking about, not because I find his views persuasive, but because he was one of the few people who senior Chinese leaders would talk to, business leaders would talk to, and therefore he'd be a source of information, if nothing else. So I think Beijing sees Paul Keating through the same lens. Beijing knows that China and Australia have many shared interests, probably wants to do much more, and itself is frustrated and probably can't understand why they see Canberra taking what they see as unnecessarily confrontational positions. And so they see Paul Keating and they say to themselves, he's a revered figure in the Labor Party. He's a former leader. We trust him and he makes sense when he talks. So to take one example, in 2021, Keating said that the Taiwan issue was, quote, not a vital Australian interest, end quote. Now, reasonable people will disagree with that assessment, but it's not an insane claim. And some Australians, including inside the foreign policy establishment, would agree with it. And so I imagine Beijing struggles to see how Australia can calculate that Taiwan as a vital interest for Canberra. To them, that's patently not true, and Keating is only speaking sense. So according to this model, the Keating visit isn't a power play. It's part of their how they do diplomacy and statecraft. Work with people you know and trust, try to reach a mutual understanding of respecting interests, and go from there. The problem is that Paul Keating is not a good fit for the Kissinger model. Kissinger was fundamentally always a diplomat, an effective behind-the-scenes actor, and a hugely controversial one, yes, but very measured in how he spoke publicly. He was very diplomatic. And that, of course, as all Australians know, is not Paul Keating. His great strength as a political leader was the bombast. It was being caustic and controversial. He was a hero of mine growing up in the 1990s because he was able to use language so effectively to critique his opponents. And we all remember him describing AUKUS as the worst international decision by a Labor government since conscription in World War I. So I want to bring in a quote from our dear friend Alan Gingell now, who most listeners will know worked closely with Keating when he was Prime Minister as his international advisor, and they remained close friends throughout their lives, and Keating actually spoke at Alan's memorial service last year. This is way back in episode 84, the early days of AUKUS, when Keating had published an op-ed that was very controversial, I think it was September, and actively prompted a sitting member, Peter Khalil, to publish an article refuting him. And you might remember, Stephen, the title was Paul Keating's My Hero, But He's Wrong About AUKUS, or something like that.
I remember that piece, yeah.
And I talked about this with Alan in this episode. And to quote Alan here, quote, "At least one of the jobs of politicians is to shift the frame of public reference in order to broaden the debate and engage different participants in the discussion. Politicians give permission to speak, if you like, to the voters at large." So that is how I read this article and his earlier statements. Not as a careful analysis of the appropriate response to China's actions at this time. It was certainly not addressed to the members of whatever Australian equivalent of the Washington Blob is called, but to the general public, and in language they were likely to remember and feel able to comment on. I saw Keating's op-ed in the same category as his famous claim back in the 1980s that Australia was about to become a banana republic. I don't think he literally believed that was true, but the debate which followed was an essential part of the reforms the Hawke Keating government introduced, end quote. Now, back then I was persuaded, Stephen, that Allen was making a good point about an effective way of influencing public debate. Of course, I have quibbles and major concerns indeed with Keating's analysis of China and the strategic landscape, but I can see the model and I can see the mechanism at work. But the problem is that that kind of role that Allen describes really disqualifies him from fitting into a Kissinger model because he's too radioactive, he's too controversial. It means ALP leaders publicly have to distance themselves from him. I do wonder, I'm sure probably his general counsel is sought in private by some members within the party still, but it is very hard, almost impossible for me to believe that he's being asked for advice on foreign policy matters. And it is true that in many places inside the Canberra bubble, he's a punchline, right? People don't take him seriously at all. And so the result is I actually assess that Foreign Minister Wong actually did China's interests more harm than good in meeting with him. If you want to chat with him, send your ambassador, as they have before, or even put him on a plane and meet with him in Beijing. But to do this on this visit, given the significance, given the scrutiny, was counterproductive to Beijing's interests. But my message on the Australian side is not to get too worked up about it. If you consider the Kissinger model and how it fits it with China's cultural understandings of diplomacy, how it fits with China's strategic thinking about the bilateral relationship, you might be offended by it, but I actually think it's actually a solid data point that Beijing really does want to get their bilateral relationship going again, of course, on their own terms, but that there is great interest in trying to put energy into that relationship. It's a long model, Stephen, but any reactions from you?
Darren, that's a really useful bit of analysis, and thank you for it. It's, as ever, really, really thoughtful. And I think it is worth thinking about Keating as a Kissinger. I tend to agree with you that there are a few things that make Keating too radioactive to fit into that model. I'll just make a couple of other additional observations on that. One, it's worth remembering just how personal Keating's attacks on Penny Wong have been. It's easy to forget in the wake of the recent statements that Paul Keating issued, which were, to his credit, extremely conciliatory, contained no criticisms of the Australian government. But it's very hard to square those most recent statements with some of the invective and personal, almost abuse, that Keating has heaped on Penny Wong. Listeners will, I'm sure, remember the quip about her trawling around the Pacific with a lei around her neck, handing out money rather than doing hard foreign policy. The other thing that I think is worth noting here is that Chinese diplomats here would have been keenly aware that as soon as the news of the Keating meeting got out, as it inevitably was at some point, that it would dominate the media coverage at the very least around this meeting. And to some extent, blow any positive press out of the water. The meeting was always going to be, to some degree, defined by the sit-down for 1 hour and 5 minutes with Keating. And the Chinese were sufficiently focused on the model that you laid out so as not to care about any attendant damage that might do to the atmospherics, at the very least, around the relationship. None of this actually disproves what you were saying or means that your model there isn't a useful one. I guess all I'm saying is that I put perhaps a little bit more emphasis than you on the recalibration on their terms. I think China is pursuing recalibration, but I think the choice to privilege Keating is just another bit of evidence that China remains intent as the bigger player to do it on their terms, and that they're not above throwing their weight around when necessary, even when that might be finally counterproductive to that long-term aim of stabilization.
All right. Well, that's a useful corrective, Stephen. Thank you very much. Just
I wouldn't say corrective. I'd just say it's an additional observation. No, I think your model is a useful one.
All right. Well, just one more question. Speaking of on someone's terms, do you think Donald Trump knew who Kevin Rudd was when he called him nasty in a response to a leading question by Nigel Farage earlier in the week?
Look, I have no idea, really. My suspicion is that he didn't, if only because if you look at the way that Trump tends to deal with questions when he doesn't know someone or isn't confident of the subject matter, he does tend to just make stuff up. So my guess, and it's no more than a guess, having watched the tape a couple of times now, is that he had only at best vaguely heard of Kevin Rudd before, but basically his response was really just drawing on the prompts that Farage gave him. Farage described him as a person who was unfriendly to Trump, and therefore Trump was instinctively very hostile to him, and so he threw out a few gratuitous insults. I mean, that sounds to me like the Donald Trump we have become acquainted with over the last decade. So my guess is that he had not a clue exactly who Kevin Rudd was. That doesn't mean that there won't necessarily or potentially be some difficult questions for Penny Wong and Anthony Albanese should Trump regain power about Kevin Rudd's tenure. But I would argue, as others already have, that we are going to have much, much bigger issues and problems to wrestle with than Kevin Rudd's position should Trump take office once again in November. Darren, I'll point people to a really good piece that Dan Flitton put out on the Lowy Interpreter earlier this week, which was, I think, entitled "Don't Be Timid About Trump Australia, Just Roll With the Punches," that talked through a couple of minor panics that we had this week, first over Kevin Rudd and Donald Trump, also about the Keating meeting, and then you might recall Don Farrell's observation to the Senate earlier this week that New Zealand rather than the United States might be Australia's most trusted ally. Now, Don Farrell's loose lips were probably unhelpful, and I'm certainly not necessarily endorsing his assessment, but I did feel like our collective response to all three of these events was perhaps just a little bit over-egged. Dan's overall point is not that we should be indifferent to what Trump or Wang Yi says or who they meet to, but we should just have a little bit more confidence in our own weight and be a little bit less shrill in our responses to the various pronouncements or signalling from either Washington and Beijing. And I think, broadly speaking, that's pretty good advice.
I agree. Stephen, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for talking with me today.
Darren, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
That's all for today's episode of Australia in the World. I thank Walter Colnaghi for research and audio editing, and of course Rory Stenning for composing our theme music. We will talk to you again soon. Thank you.